Returning to our program is attorney Stuart Gardner to talk about, what are we going to talk about? Some legal stuff, Stuart.
Legal stuff sounds good, Doug.
We barely got warmed up last week when you were on the show talking about some of this. And
yeah, all kinds of interesting things in the law. One thing that I think is real interesting is what happened to Brian Eppes.
Well, yeah, let's take 3 minutes and have you tell that story.
Brian Eppes, if memory serves me, was involved in a car accident and was suffering from horrible pain and was taking all kinds of drugs to alleviate his pain. And after a few years, he was barely able to function, but one of the doctors turned him on to marijuana.
Uh-huh.
He started using it and everything went great. He was able to attend the university and got an electrical degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then he actually attended law school. Mm-hmm. So this is not your normal pothead.
Right.
This is somebody who's actually turned it around and become a very productive citizen. When he saw the medical marijuana initiative pass, he decided to actually start growing his own plants
mm-hmm.
so that he could supply himself and other people who had medical marijuana.
We should
problems.
Remind the listener, the state more or less said there was legitimate use for medical marijuana. However, the federal government most emphatically did not agree.
Actually, that's very interesting, Doug, because it's my understanding that in San Francisco, in the district over there, you were allowed to grow medical marijuana. And we're in the Eastern District, the federal Eastern District. That's mm-hmm. why they decided, hey, this guy's in Chico. We've got him in the more conservative area of California. Let's prosecute him and make an example of this guy.
So he was growing X number of marijuana plants and distributing it to people for the use as medical marijuana.
It was very well controlled.
And I guess authorities knew all about it. He basically...
This is Chico. This isn't... He's not hiding.
Right.
And I don't think local law enforcement even knew about it,
right.
if memory serves
me. So what happened here? How did they decide to go after him?
The feds moved in and decided, hey, you know what? This guy's growing a lot of medical marijuana plants. We're going to make an example of him. And they prosecuted him. And they convicted him. And they sentenced him to 10 years in federal prison. With 85% of the time he'll have to spend. It's not half time in the federal system.
Now, in the state conviction, you can get out in half the time.
Oh, yeah.
Feds, you serve in 85%.
Feds are tough.
He's got 8.5 years for the crime of growing marijuana.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, he thought everything was legal. Everybody knew he was doing it. I mean, anyone that looks at the news sees these guys down in Santa Cruz doing all kinds of great things in San Francisco. This would be no big deal. And here, this guy's in Chico, thought he was following the law, and now he's been completely hosed.
Well, I understand people are trying to do what they can to appeal this case, and what recourse
does he
have?
Where are you going to end up appealing to? The Ninth Circuit, they're not going to sit there and throw out all the federal marijuana laws for the whole country. And if they did, the Supreme Court is very likely to overrule them.
So this poor guy's been in the wrong place at the wrong time, and overzealous federal prosecutors who ought to be going after people like Kozlowski at Tyco and Kenneth Lay at Enron for bankrupting millions of people instead are devoting their energies toward a guy growing pot in the backyard.
Oh, yeah. It's even better than that because there were protesters out there with little signs and stuff, and basically, the judge said something, and maybe the clerk misheard, and they went out there with the U.S. Marshals and cleared the streets and threw some of these people in jail, and now they're prosecuting some of those people who are handing out pamphlets and medical marijuana. It's really the state at its worst, and the federal government is really, really acting like jerks in this one.
No argument from me. I think we can agree from the medical and legal standpoint, this is very stupid.
Sometimes what the government does really is repressive, and this is a perfect example.
All right. Well, I guess we'll continue to follow that story. Well, here's a case I wanted to talk about with you. The Supreme Court is going to, I guess this summer, review the University of Michigan's enrollment policies both in the undergraduate school and at the law school. As regards quotas or not quotas to achieve racial balance, affirmative action. The White House, this is the first time the Supreme Court has addressed this the matter of affirmative action, since 1978, when Alan Bakke versus the Board of Regents, right here at the UC Davis School of Medicine, attracted national attention, a sharply divided court struck down racial quotas in school admission, but allowed race to be used in deciding which students to accept. Now, it's funny because I was a student at UCD at the time. I was applying to medical school at that time. I didn't get into UCD, but a lot of friends of mine did. I was there the day that Bakke showed up, and I remember this car pulled up, and a very, very distraught-looking guy stepped out, sees all these reporters milling about, and just makes a beeline for the building and disappeared inside of it, and they held a press conference without him to get various students' reaction and blah, blah, blah. It was an interesting ruling. I was very shocked that they admitted Bakke to UCD School of Medicine, and that a very narrowly defined ruling said that you can't set aside seats and say those are the minority seats, and yet you're still allowed to use race as a criteria for admission. So all it did was saying you can't set aside a quota, but that's all it did.
Yeah.
So what they're trying to claim now, the Bush administration, I guess, has filed a friend of the court brief.
Yep.
To help this case that wants to overturn the issue of affirmative action.
Yeah, and I totally agree, and almost every lawyer studies the Bakke decision. It's one of the big ones in constitutional law, and it's about time we get rid of this. I mean, this is a society that's built upon the ideas that you're judged by your merits, not by your color.
Well, but I certainly don't have any problem looking back in time and saying that, you know, with the inequalities and old boys network that's been in place, you know, that rich kids' sons got into med school. They pulled strings. They still do. But this was a way in the late 60s of saying we've got to do something about this. We need to have we need to get people who are minorities in these places, and they set up these programs. I don't think that in the past it was unreasonable to have done this to seek redress. However, I have to agree with you that you can't extend this indefinitely into the future, and you can't just set aside slots and say these are going to go to minority.
Yeah,
students.
One of the interesting things about the whole racial quota system and how it really got going is that you saw what was happening in the 60s down south. And down south, if you were black, you weren't getting into anywhere.
Absolutely.
No way. So the whole quota system made sense, but you do have to have a cutoff.
Yeah.
Sometime, and it's been 40 years since the 60s. And I think it's time that we quit judging people in the color of their skin and start looking, you know, certainly you look at their background. I mean, obviously, some black kid coming from Oakland who had to struggle and work real hard to get into a position to succeed probably does deserve it a lot more than some rich kid.
Right. I mean, I think a meritorious system of evaluation would as a no-brainer, take that into account.
Right. You would think so, but that's not the way things always work.
I guess not. You know, just some random thoughts I have on the issue is it so happens I did get into medical school the year after Mr. Bakke, and I was part of the UC system. So, you know, we had kids that were there that were granted special admissions. It wasn't a quota, but they took that into account. And I myself have always had some, you know, and I'm truly some of my best pals in my class were, you know, special admissions guys and gals. I don't have any problem with the idea of doing, you know, in general, taking this into account.
Oh, I have a big problem if you're just going to set aside spots for minority students.
Well, what they wound up doing, and just sort of, you know, a very silly little, you know, they didn't call them. They didn't say we're going to set aside. Davis, UCD, the med school, had set aside 16 slots that were designated the minority slots.
Right.
Now, the Supreme Court decided you can't do that.
Sure.
So what they did instead was just say, we want to have a certain number. We won't say what it is. We just want to have a certain mix. And, you know, therefore they're not setting aside 16 empty seats that are going to be filled with, you know, minority faces. But in the end, it's so silly because you're doing the same thing. And to some degree, it makes a certain amount of sense. But here's a point that, you know, I can't resist bringing up. I, by my ethnic background, which is Portuguese, am considered as much a white person as the Prince of Wales. You know, I'm of European ancestry. There is no program set aside to forward my, you know,
yeah,
cause. However, because this strange heading of Hispanic, for reasons I don't understand, includes people from Spain. In other words, if my grandfather was born on this Portuguese side of the border, and the guy in the next village 7 miles to the east is born in Spain, he is by definition a minority and Hispanic, and my and I am not. I know people, and I remember hearing of this case. I know this is a fact. I know the source it came from. I know of a gal that got admitted as a minority, okay, underrepresented person who needs extra help to get admitted, okay? Well, I can understand this being applied to Mexican Americans, Chicanos, people from, you know, the New World, but I've always wondered, why is someone from Spain any different from somebody from Portugal or France? This person had two parents who were physicians of Spanish ancestry and still considered to be someone who needed extra help in getting in. Well, that's just stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's time that affirmative action goes away. I think it's time the program ends.
And I think the Supreme Court
is going to strike down this race-based idea, and I don't think they're going to allow it anymore. Just flat up.
Well, but I mean, what are they going to do? They're going to say you can't take it into consideration?
Yeah.
Because it's a valid point to be taken into consideration. That's why the Bakke decision, I thought, you know, made a certain amount of sense.
No, the Bakke decision was the first blow, but this is going to be a final stake in the coffin.
You think?
I do. Well, I'd bet money on it.
I'll be curious to see what happens.
I'll bet money on it. It just seems completely obvious to me.
Well, okay. We'll follow that story. Here's a related story, very much related story to this issue. Sitting on our Supreme Court at the present time is someone who benefited from the past policies in this country of affirmative action. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was advanced throughout his educational career by various programs in affirmative action.
I think that takes a lot away from Clarence Thomas. Had those programs not been there, there's no reason to believe that he might not have succeeded by himself. And
well,
by saying,
that's true.
Hey, the only reason he made it is because the programs kind of takes it away from him as if he wasn't worthy to make it by himself.
I'm not saying the only reason he succeeded was because of the programs. I'm saying that Clarence Thomas benefited from such programs.
It couldn't have hurt.
Well, most particularly, he would not be warming the bench on the Supreme Court right now if, in essence, George Bush Sr., in a move that can only be construed as affirmative action in a very twisted and perverted, diabolically clever way, was put on the bench to replace Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall deserved to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. He did not seek it, but Lyndon Johnson felt he should be there. It was time we had a black face on the Supreme Court. Thurgood Marshall served admirably in that role. He had argued 32 times before the United States Supreme Court. He was the lead attorney in Brown versus Board of Education, which overturned basically separate but equal. He was a man who, you know, served very well. When it was time for him to step down during the George Bush the First presidency, they claimed at first, well, there's no such thing as a black spot. There's no black seat in the Supreme Court. We are not going to go out and seek out a black man, so they said. We're going to seek out the best judge in this country to put in his place. So people were rather stunned when this rather undistinguished judge, Clarence Thomas, who'd been on the bench for only 18 months, who was black, was suddenly seen as the man they wanted for the role. He was clearly not the most distinguished judge in the United States, but he was a politically desirable background. He was a man you could count on to toe the conservative line, and he was black. So,
well, I bet you there were a lot of people that disagreed that Thurgood Marshall was the most qualified judge also.
Well, I don't know if there is such a thing, but there's such a thing as being very, very good and, you know, very, you know, top line and being not top line. Clarence Thomas was not in the front line.
Perhaps the Democrats picked the very best black judge they could find. Perhaps the Republicans picked the very best black judge they could find.
Stuart, it's much more likely they picked a black judge for the Supreme Court who was politically reliable.
Actually, I think that is the litmus test for Supreme Court justices. If you get rid of color and everything, if you try your damnedest to pick Supreme Court justices that you think will interpret the law as you believe them they should be interpreted.
Well, Clarence Thomas may get to help decide whether he's going to invalidate affirmative action, something which, again, he benefited from in his political career, which I think is very curious. Clarence Thomas also, and I want to ask you about this, sold his memoirs to HarperCollins, which is a division of the News Corporation owned by Rupert Murdoch, the man who also puts Fox News out there for our enjoyment. Rupert Murdoch set out to make Clarence Thomas a millionaire. His memoirs sold for $1.5 million, just his memoirs. And, of course, in the past, they tried to give Newt Gingrich $4.5 million for his memoirs back in 94, but the congressional offices said that looks unseemly. So he had to accept only $1 million for his memoir. But basically, Rupert Murdoch has decided to make Clarence Thomas a millionaire, even though, you know, what's Thomas going to do in the future when it's involving cases of Fox, Murdoch, media cases? I mean, is he going to, like, recuse himself and leave the Supreme Court to have a 4-4, deadlock?
Actually, that just happened. I think Justice Kennedy, it was one of the cases here. It was an environmental law case where I think it was Secopolis was doing some deep plowing, and Justice Kennedy knew him and recused himself. So, yeah, Clarence Thomas would recuse himself if it was Fox or Rupert Murdoch. I think the thing that looks unseemly with this one is that you get the advance $1 million fee. But certainly if Clarence Thomas was just taking a percentage, that would be looking a lot better to me, because then if he sold 10 million books, got a buck each, he'd be making $10 million. You don't know that Rupert Murdoch isn't trying to make money on this story.
Well, it's interesting. In a related story we'll get to in a minute, the Supreme Court just ruled that copyrights need to be extended for Mickey Mouse and all kinds of movies and songs. Now, the big beneficiaries of this...
Disney,
which happens to own
ABC,
perhaps not coincidentally ABC, and AOL Time Warner, which also happens to own CNN. These guys all of a sudden have profited immensely from the Supreme Court's decision to extend copyrights out to 70 years after the death of a work's author, and for things like movies, 95 years after their creation, extending it out 20 more years.
Well, yeah, that's amazing. You know, the interesting thing, I'm sorry to get off track a little bit, is that Disney opposed the VHS machine and allowing people to watch home movies. And now one of the greatest beneficiaries of these VHS machines and the DVDs has to be Disney.
Isn't that
reselling.
Isn't that interesting?
It's comical when you think about it, because they opposed it so strenuously.
Well, in a similar vein, I think it is irony in the extreme to realize that Clarence Thomas may overturn affirmative action. He wound up winning. This is where this talk about diabolically clever. He wound up winning the confirmation by a vote of 52-48. There were issues of sexual harassment involving Anita Hill, for which she was just pilloried by the right. Although I think she was telling the truth about what happened. But anyway, the senators weren't sure what to do. Numerous Southern senators were not sure how to vote on Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearing. They asked their constituents, what do you want me to do? People like Howell Heflin in Alabama. And his state and other states in the South with a large black population more or less rallied behind Clarence and said, we want him on the bench, thinking they're going to get another Thurgood Marshall. Clarence Thomas then won the vote by a squeaker, and he set about to follow whatever Antonin Scalia tells him to do. Clarence Thomas, should not be on the bench.
It's like a little puppet or something.
He's notorious for sitting silently. He never asks questions. He closes his eyes throughout most oral arguments. The only thing he will talk to is like the very the arch conservative press. Rush Limbaugh is supposedly going to read this new book out by HarperCollins on the air, and Clarence has agreed to go out in some kind of a book stump to put forward this whole idea. This is very unseemly. It's wrong, and Rupert Murdoch is pulling the strings behind all of this for his own benefit. He hired this agent that apparently was the same agent that fostered this other book that attacked Anita Hill. And which, by the way, the author then backed away all the claims he made in the book. Says, oh, yeah, I guess I was being a little hard on her. And he's, you know, said that this was not true. I should, in fairness, point out that Anita Hill did make $1 million for her book as well. So there's a great potential. I mean, I believe she told the truth. I don't think that she benefited professionally from what she had to say. But then, of course, she did make money off the book. So
yeah, and then didn't she get the American way. Didn't she become a professor at the University of Oklahoma?
She was, I believe, already a professor. But anyway, in
so
the future,
she didn't do any worse.
Well, let's just close with it with the Doonesbury cartoon that came out this week that shows the four panel strip. They're reading mail, supposedly, in Doonesbury. Mike Doonesbury says, dear guys, any truth to the story that Doonesbury is now controlled by Rupert Murdoch and Fox News? Next frame. No, none. That's an ugly, vicious smear attack by Queen Hillary and her fellow femme Nazis. Silence in the third panel. Mike Doonesbury goes, what just happened? Zonker goes, hey, it's him. And then off panel, somebody's going, carry on. The deal fell through. Yeah, you know, we need to talk in the future. There was a very good article we talked about a few weeks back, an editorial from the Sacramento News and Review by Sue Wilson, talked about media diversity, and good God, this country needs more of that. We're going to cite Project Censored, 2003, a book that's out on the shelves. We need to go over some of what's in here for you. They have a five-page summary of the 10 large media corporations that control most of what's out there. And this is going to be a topic worthy of discussion at length in its own right, but we're out of time today.
We're going to get a chance to go after that one.
No, I think we should talk about Murdoch because his news corporation is extremely influential. And when they got once they got rid of the fairness standard in American media, you could have a Fox Network and a Rush Limbaugh, you know, come forward and just put out, you know, one party's viewpoint 24/7 without any fear of, you know, having to air contrary opinions. Well, anyway, it's interesting that a kingmaker, a media mogul like Murdoch, is permitted to get around federal ethics laws. Now, Stuart, there's a $23,000 annual limit on the income a member of the federal judiciary may earn from outside activities such as teaching, but earnings from books are exempt from the cap. Hence, you can make a millionaire out of a guy in one fell swoop.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Well, Stuart, thanks again. It's been interesting talking about the law.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Stuart Gardner, Sean Minton, and Dr. Whitney Lehman for their contributions to this program. We will see you again next Thursday at 5 o'clock with hopefully some interesting stories to tell you about what's going on down in the Caribbean. Stay tuned now for Todd Urich and Hometown Atrocities, Todd's most interesting and eclectic selection of music for your listening pleasure. This has been Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. Oh yeah, I'm Douglas Everett. Money, 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 money.